Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to those of you who have come to realize, or at least open to the realization, that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt and counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, toll free, 877-376-45. Lebanese authorities earlier this week arrested a fugitive radical Sunni preacher. Fugitive? I guess that means that he was evading the law. Radical. I don't know what that means. That means, I guess, they don't want to say that he was a fundamentalist for fear that people would connect acts of terrorism with Islam. But radical is the term that is used. Preacher. Now, this is interesting in that we're not talking about a political leader here, but a religious leader. We're not talking about someone who is unfamiliar with Islam, who, because they are unfamiliar with Islam, may be corrupting the religion. No, we're talking about an Islamic preacher. Sunni, just to designate the fact that he is part of the majority of Islam. And it should be noted that Sunni is a very telling term when it applies to Islam. The Sunnah is the aspect of Islam that comprises the religion. The religion is based almost entirely on Sunnah. Now, Muslims would protest and say, no, it's based on the Quran. And no, it isn't. The Quran doesn't isn't followed. The Quran is a jumbled mess. All five pillars of Islam are derived from instructions and examples set in the Sunnah. The entirety of Sharia law is based on the Sunnah. And virtually everything Muslims say and do, Muslims think and believe, the whole history of Islam is founded on the Sunnah. So what is Sunnah? Sunnah is the example of Muhammad. The Quran says that Muhammad's example is the best for Muslims to follow. And would we realize that Muhammad was a pedophile, a rapist, a thief, a mass murderer, and a ruthless terrorist? That's not so good. That's the reason that Team Islam is so vicious and vile around the world. So this individual is a Sunni, which is based on the Sunnah, or example of Muhammad, Muslim. And he was trying to leave the country. Sheikh Ahmad al-Asir was detained at the Beirut airport. He had been on the run. Now, if you're on the run, are you going to go to the central airport, the place where they have the most cameras and the most security? I don't think so. Since classes with the Lebanese army back in 2013, which at least 17 soldiers were killed, the cleric organized followers to fight alongside rebels in Syria in response to Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia group, which backs President Bashar al-Assad. Hezbollah, which means Allah's party, is a Shiite group for sure. Although they did not designate them as Shia in this article, maybe just an omission or stupidity being manifest by the journalist. And while they are, there are many members of Hezbollah that are based in Lebanon, they are not a Lebanese group. They are a Iranian group. Hezbollah was founded by Iran, is armed by Iran, is controlled by Iran, is deployed by Iran. And they aren't backers of President Bashar al-Assad. They are loyal to the Ayatollah Khamenei. And so when the Ayatollah backs Bashar al-Assad because he is their puppet and gives them far-reaching influence all the way to Lebanon, Hezbollah does the bidding of the Ayatollah. The BBC regional analyst, Usher, says that the media savvy sheikh, media savvy, you know, to be media savvy, all that means is that you can play the media as if they were a fiddle. You know, a fiddle is just an inanimate object. It will sound whatever sound the operator causes it to play. And to a large degree, that is the nature of the media today. When you hear and watch, listen to, read a media individual, someone who writes for a magazine, a newspaper, a blog, or does a radio or television commentary, those individuals seem incapable of actually influencing the outcome of the discussion in any kind of a knowledgeable way. When somebody says something that is not true, they seem incapable of being able to confront them and say, no, that's not true, or that's inconsistent, or why don't you try to prove that, demonstrate that with some evidence that's inconsistent with history or the facts. They will never do so. And so they're just simply played. So if you have a position, you can, and so long as your position is considered acceptable according to political correctness, which means you can advance the lies of Islam or any lies that are endorsed by socialist secular humanism, play the media as if you're playing a fiddle. It's not hard. You don't have to be media savvy. You just have to be aware that most of those operating in today's media have had to be so loyal, so indoctrinated by political correctness that they've lost the ability to be judgmental. They've lost the ability to think rational. They've lost the ability to be moral. They've lost the ability to be discerning, so they can be played like an inanimate object. The cleric, according to this article, has been one of the fiercest voices, most violent, most jihadist, stoking up sectarian tensions as the Syrian war has raged next door, the sectarian tensions. Let's be clear. Sunnis and Shias have been at each other's throats for 1,300 years. No one is stoking the tensions. They will continue to view each other as apostates, worthy of death. They will both apply the Quran's definition of apostate to the other, and they will continue to be at war with each other. No one is stoking the sectarian tensions. It's part of the fabric of Islam, and it's really not different than Imperial Rome was, and that the Roman Catholic Church became. You know, in Imperial Rome, it was one emperor claiming to be divine and having a divine mandate with legions loyal to him that would attack other emperors in the empire, or wannabe emperors in the empire that had legions that were loyal to him as he claimed a divine manifest destiny to rule. And they would war with each other. And as Rome split between East and West, the East and West waged bitter battles between each other. And then as Rome itself began, the city of Rome began to erode and decay, and Constantinople began to rise in power, during the time past circa 400 CE, when Theodosius had established Christianity as not only the official religion of his political empire, but also the only allowable religion for his empire. At that point, there was wars between Eastern Christendom and Western Christendom over who would control the religion, who would be empowered. Very similar to those battles, and even the battles that existed during and immediately after the Crusades began between what then became a splinter, the Eastern Orthodox Church, fighting the Roman Catholic Church, and even later when Protestant Christianity emerged, the Roman Catholic Church fighting the Anabaptists and Protestant Christians. And this is what has been the fate of Islam all along. It is also, even in political doctrines, when you have a variety of competing communist or fascist thugs, they will vie for each other, with each other for power. If you look at the mafia, a similar organization to Islam, mafia dons vie for each, with each other for power and control. This is part of Islam. It is never going to stop until one side is bludgeoned into submission. So I think it's really one of the more interesting topics on Islam is that with the United States having artificially and substantially increased the influence of Shia Islam, and we did it in a lot of ways. First, we removed their only foe, their only active foe in Saddam Hussein, and his fight against Shiite Iran and Iraq. We, as a nation, even prior to that, we removed the Shah from power and replaced the Shah via Carter's bumblings with the Ayatollah Khomeini. So no matter how you dissect this, the United States set the wheels in power that gave Iraq to Iran, eliminating their only enemy, empowering Shiite influence over Iran, and then enriching Iran with Iran West, which is Iraq. And then we provided a mighty army for Iran, and the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars. And we're continuing to provide an army for the Iranians via the Iraqi army. And then, on top of that, when the Sunnis in Iraq rose up as the Islamic State to rebuff the atrocities being perpetrated against them by the Shiites in Iran, then the United States started bombing the Sunnis in support of the Shiites. And then to cap all of that off, the United States decides that it will lift all of the sanctions on Iran for essentially nothing, enabling them to complete their nuclear ambitions. But more importantly, and this is vastly more important, if so few people are talking about this, it enables the Shiites, which are outmanned 5-1 and outgunned 25-1, to finance a conventional military that gives them the ability to fight on for another decade or more. And that is the greatest tragedy of this whole endeavor, is that this fighting between Sunni and Shia is now going to claim the lives of millions of people. Sheikh Asher built his reputation on television talk shows. Imagine that it's okay to have a fundamentalist Muslim advocating jihad, killing other Muslims, on talk shows. And yet when my videos are put on Facebook, for example, where we are talking about using our words to express our indignation towards doctrines that authorize, justify, inspire pedophilia, rape, kidnap, and the enslavement of little children, that's considered hate speech, which is intolerable. And yet he has built a reputation doing talk shows. The self-proclaimed defender of Sunni rights against the Shia movement. Shia is not a movement. It represents 15 to 20% of all Muslims. It's like saying that that Eastern Orthodox Christianity is a movement. I tell you what, it is astonishing, really, how poor a job academic institutions have done educating college graduates. To write for a major periodical, you were an English major or a journalist major, or communication major in college. You've had 4 years of college. You're paid to research and write. And you come up with the Shia movement. Hezbollah and its backing of Syrian President Assad, with no mention, of course, of Hezbollah, what the name means, or the fact that Hezbollah is an Iranian organization. Ask some questions, folks. Think about it. Learn. Tell the truth. What a novel approach. This is an interesting...
I have a question.
Yeah, okay, good.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to news agencies reporting, like news being actual facts? Like,
yeah, really.
Like, because you said, you know, they went to school. And
right.
During school, were they allowed to just, you know, research and only report the things that fit into what they wanted? Or did their teachers expect them to report, you know, the facts that they found?
The purpose of a newscast is threefold today. Number one, it is to promote socialist secular humanism and therefore political correctness. Number two, it is to entertain so that you achieve an audience. And that means that you need to focus on things that tantalize people. And that means that you're not trying to educate, you're not trying to inform, you're simply trying to entertain. Number three is to advance the careers of those who are participating in the process. And they can only advance if they toe the line of political correctness. It's reached a point now where socialist secular humanism and political correctness requires the individual to ignore the facts and to misrepresent the facts to promote an agenda. And so political correctness is almost always incorrect. That's what happened. Here's an interesting story, and I'm going to tell you that from my perspective, that while Islam is to blame here, there is a greater villain here even than Islam, and it is the same villain. It is political correctness. It is the British academic institutions that are indoctrinating people, the young students, in political correctness, which precludes them thinking judgmentally. It precludes them forming rational conclusions. It precludes them being moral and discerning. So they're capable of making absolutely moronic decisions based upon absolute rubbish. So let me tell you the story. It says, ask any young Muslim woman in the neighborhood, these are the neighborhoods surrounding London, what kind of guys are popular at school these days? And they will start raving about the brothers who pray. Now, of course, in Islam, I got to be really careful with prayer. God doesn't want you to pray to him. Never once asked you to pray to him. Never once. And he's got a whole Torah that is five books filled with instructions. He has countless prophets that tell you every aspect of life, past, present, and future, and never once asks you to pray to him.
Well,
ever.
What does you praying to him do for him?
Nothing.
It does nothing.
Nothing. What does it do for you?
Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, don't get me wrong. It's nothing wrong with talking to God. Don't pray to him. Don't tell God what you want. Don't tell God what you think you need. Don't ask God to do you favors.
But again, that does
something
for him.
And don't even speak to God unless you have first listened to him. And how would you listen to him, Scott?
The Torah. Follow the Torah.
Recite his Torah, right? Recite his Torah. Listen to what he has to say first. He's smarter than you are. So when it comes to prayer, and it's important first to know that Yahweh never asks us to pray to him. And the reason he doesn't is that the things he asks us to do are in our interest and ultimately in his interest. And since he is unfathomably smarter than we are, since he knows vastly better what is in our interest than we do, since his fatherly advice is a trillion times superior to my advice to my sons. And I really did work hard to provide quality, thoughtful advice to my sons, where I provided, you know, background and experiences and evidence and reason and examples of where I had tried other things and they failed and tried certain things and they succeeded, and then put it in the context of other people who had succeeded and failed and lots of background. And, you know, I've had a lot of experiences in my life, and I really worked at it with my sons to provide quality advice. Yahweh's advice to his children is infinitely superior to that. So what is there's two things, Scott, that probably 1,000 times over his Torah instructions, Yahweh encourages us to do. We know that he never asks us to pray to him, ever. But what are the two things that he does ask us to do?
Well, yes, you follow the Torah and Psalms. And
well, actually not follow, but
well,
how about there's two words.
Mm-hmm.
He wants you to engage in the covenant. The two words are shama and shamar. They're related Hebrew terms. Shama means to listen, and shamar means to observe. To observe is to closely examine and carefully consider. So what he's asking you to do is use your eyes and your ears.
Yep.
Okay. Eyes and ears. So if you're using your eyes, you're reading his Torah. Use your ears, you're listening to the recital of Yahweh's Torah instructions. And so what God says, if you know, if you'll take the time to prioritize who I, what I have to say, A, you'll come to know who I am. You'll come to know that I exist. You'll come to either decide you want to have a relationship with me or not. Your choice. You know, I'm not going to change. I'm not trying to blow smoke here. This is who I am. If you take the time to get to know me and you happen to like me, if you're interested in what I have to offer, at least you'll know what those things are. And, you know, they're fairly important. If you listen to what I have to say and you pay attention to what I have revealed by observing it, reading it, and examining it, considering it. So those are the two things he wants us to do. And then once we do that, then you're right. He wants us to engage. He wants us to respond. You know, it's like a father. I didn't want my children to tell me, take a silly game. It wasn't appropriate for my sons to tell me how to play golf. Not initially. You know, I was a scratch golfer. I could tell my sons the fundamentals of the grip, the stance, the swing, and the strategy of the game. And so when we began with their first clubs to play golf, there is a certain protocol, there's an etiquette that's associated with the game. And then there are rules of the game, and then there's techniques and strategies used in the game. It was appropriate for them to listen to and watch, observe what I had to say. And then the thing I wanted them to do was to engage and to respond. And after a while now, you know, my sons are pretty good golfers. They give dad tips. You know, we exchange ideas now, and we've moved from one aspect to a steady conversation. One of the people that I've grown to like the most is the gentleman that has the BlessYahweh.com website where all of these shows are presented in their entirety, and they are categorized. So if you just want to listen to a particular topic, you can do it. And he was like so many that I've come to know, and I don't want to say that Richard is like a lot of other people. Richard's a very unique individual. That's what one of the things that I find makes him special. But he was like so many that having gone through tough times, as we all have, he particularly loved the closeness that he felt to our Heavenly Father, to Yahweh, through rather constant communication. And when I pointed out that God never once asked us to pray to him, and that you know, we're a lot better off listening to him, that I don't pray to him. I listen to him, I observe what he has to say, and then I respond. And sometimes with the thrilled enthusiasm. You know, his first response was, you know, don't take that away from me. And it was kind of almost angry at me. And I understood where he was coming from. But, you know, I think that as Richard has grown in the relationship with Yahweh, he may talk to Yahweh as much as he ever did, but the fact is now that it is definitely and unequivocally a conversation. And that's the enjoyment that God gets out of it. Once we come to know who he is, we engage. And we can engage exactly like Abraham did. A lot of give and take, like Moshe did. Lots of give and take, like Dode did. Lots of give and take. That's the way that he would like us to engage. Anyway, the Islamic prayer, by contrast, is a memorization, rote memorization. And Yahweh says, don't ever do that. Even Yosha said, you know, these rote, memorized, thoughtless prayers are just repulsive. And even public prayers, which are almost all Muslim prayers now, are public prayers. They do it to be seen doing it. They just love the brothers to pray. God says that is totally and completely phony. Don't do it. You know, all these Christians that bow their heads and say grace before every meal, they public prayers in their churches. The guy they claim is the founder of their religion, although he's not, because he wasn't the founder of any religion, told them don't do that. But of course, Paul, the false prophet, says pray without ceasing. So these Muslim girls now are becoming more fundamentalist. They're going for the fundamentalist Muslims who pray. Girls used to want someone who was good looking. Nowadays, Muslim girls want Muslims who are practicing. They want fundamentalists. Zara Kadir, 22, who does de-radicalization work. De-radicalization, that's funny. For the Active Change Foundation, her father's charity in East London, say it's a new thing over the past couple of years. A lot of girls want that. Even some non-practicing girls want that. How do you practice? How do you practice being a Muslim? Let's see if my bowing down is appropriate, if my wearing my tent is appropriate, if my giving up all of my freedom as a woman is appropriate, me being mutilated, having my genitals mutilated by my mother is practicing? How do you practice being devalued in every and abused in every possible way? The story continues. It says the rows of housing complexes behind the main street are home to deeply conservative Muslim communities. You know, the liberals love casting religious people as conservatives. And while in America, evangelicals are typically conservative, Roman Catholics are typically liberal. But this notion that conservative and religious fundamentalism go hand in hand and can be interchanged is wrong. They are fundamentalist Islamic communities. That means they're good Muslims. That means that they're all jihadist or all supportive of jihad. Every fundamentalist Muslim is a bad person. It's impossible to be a fundamentalist Muslim and be a good person. You can be a good person and a Muslim so long as you are a really bad Muslim.
Well, maybe we've been looking at this all wrong the whole time. Maybe there's practicing Muslims who are just trying to get better at it, and then there's the professionals, which are the ones that are out there. They're doing everything that it says.
Yeah,
the professional Muslim.
Yeah, great. There you go. So a practice makes perfect. A perfect Muslim is a horrible individual. So this, as we continue with the story, it says that in this deeply conservative, we should read fundamentalist, community where the lines between religion and extremism can be blurred. That's another way of saying that it's impossible to distinguish the religion from terrorism. Extremism now, just as conservative is the politically correct term for fundamentalist, which means the perfect expression of the religion, an accurate expression of the religion, a truthful and fundamental expression of the religion. Extremism is the buzzword for terrorism, particularly when that terrorism is performed by a Muslim. It's called extremism as opposed to jihad, which is the appropriate term, or Islamic terrorism. And they say that their lines between religion, what they really meant was Islam, the lines between Islam and jihad, Islamic terrorism, can be blurred. And can be blurred is, and lines is, again, politically correct for, I don't want to make this connection. I just want you to think that maybe out there might be a connection if you're really not paying attention. You've got to be really careful. Otherwise, you know, you'll be like those morons who are right-wing wackos who will associate Islam with terrorism. And that's what's being happened here, but I don't want to go down that road. So I'm going to say lines are blurred. No. That's an outright lie. There is no distinction between Islam and terrorism. Islam equals terrorism. Islam was created as a criminal enterprise. Islam has always been engaged in terrorism for the purpose of promoting its criminal enterprise. Muhammad robbed civilians. He abused civilians. He kidnapped civilians. He killed civilians. He enslaved civilians. He took the property of civilians. And so when an armed force robs, abuses, rapes, or in any other way abuses in a very harsh way civilians, as Islam has done for all 1,400 years, that is called terrorism. And so there is no distinction between Islam, Muhammad, Allah, and terrorism. They are hand in hand, and I know that sounds harsh to those of you who haven't taken the time to study Islam, who haven't read the Quran and Hadith, who are only indoctrinated with political correctness and can't even fathom that there is no distinction between the two. But that's the facts. There is no distinction between Islamic terrorism and the Islamic religion. And so there are no lines that are being blurred here. This says after that, including in at least one of these girls' families, in this community, the everyday challenges that the girls face look very different from their male counterparts. And that is because in Islam, a woman has no worth, no value whatsoever. But yet she will seek worth and value in the religion. Stupid. The Islamic State is making a determined play for these girls, tailoring its siren calls to their vulnerabilities, their frustrations and dreams, and filling the void the West has so far failed to address. Oh, it's the West! Oh, the Islamic State is able to prey on these vulnerable girls because the West is at fault. Well, the West is at fault, but not for the reason this article portends. The West is at fault for indoctrinating students as opposed to educating them, and for making being judgmental a crime because it's opposed to the myths of political correctness. They're going to say that, you know, the girls, it's just not enough societal support. No, has nothing to do that with that. In the post-9/11 austerity Britain, you see, it's austerity. Britain is not spending enough money on these Muslims. If Britain was not in austerity mode and was giving them all manner of indulgences and entitlements, oh, then it would be so much better. Yeah, no one bothers to recognize that most of the girls who leave Britain to go play Jihad Jane with the Islamic State come from wealthy families. They, you know, the abominator says, oh, we need more education and more wealth redistribution, and if we only had more social programs and more educational opportunities, that this wouldn't happen. Throughout the world, and it's almost ubiquitous throughout the world, the wealthier the family, the more likely it is that the son or daughter is going to go off and play jihad. The better educated, the in reality indoctrinated the child, the more likely they are going to go off and play jihad. You know, those that are, whose families are hardworking and they're really struggling to make a living and they understand the sacrifice of work and are trying to better themselves and have good role models at home, they're less likely to go. But those who see that there is no promise, there's no hope, there's no joy, there's no love in this depraved religion, they're the most likely to go. So it has nothing to do with a 9/11 austerity Britain, a time when a deep crisis of identity and values has swept across the country. Fitting in can be harder for Muslim girls than for boys, buffeted by a growing hostility towards Islam. Gee, why would people have hostility towards Islam? Let's see. Are Muslims responsible for 99.9% of the terrorist acts perpetrated in the world today? Do people like terrorism? Let's see. Most people dislike terrorism. And then would it be reasonable to assume that, therefore, most people would dislike the impetus for 99.9% of terrorism? Gee, why not? Why didn't the writer of this article make that connection and say, you know, for obvious reasons, there's some people that have some, most people, for good moral reasons, are adverse to Islam because they're adverse to terrorism, and Islam is perpetrating 99% of the terrorist acts in the world. They're averse to little girls being kidnapped from their homes to be turned into sex slaves. They're adverse to beheadings, like the archaeologist, what was he, 82 years old, that was beheaded by the Islamic State yesterday. They're opposed to these things, and therefore the religion that is endorsing them, that is perpetrating them, they're hostile to. But no, we couldn't say that. No, because they want to blame society for being harsh to Muslims, being hostile to Muslims, because it's the individual who is ignorant, who is falsely attributing these bad things to Islam that is to be blamed according to political correctness, as opposed to the very fact that Muslims are responsible for 99% of terrorist acts. So it says that this hostility towards Islam and deep spending cuts that have forced women and young people in working class communities like their own, deep spending cuts. You know, Britain's federal budget hasn't decreased. Britain's not spending less money. Britain made an attempt to ratchet in the acceleration of its budget. And they probably made a better attempt at it than than the United States. But this notion that deep budget cuts, this is stupid. No deep budget cuts. At very best, there has been a deceleration in the rate of acceleration in spending. But to base this on this tendency for British girls and British boys to want to go off and play jihad on not spending enough money on entitlements, it shows that political correctness, socialist secular humanism, goes beyond blinding the individual who is faithful to it. It renders them irrational. We'll be back.